Book of Numbers, chapter 21. The children of Israel, by the time we get to Numbers chapter 21, are a little bit discouraged. It's a real big time of transition for them as a nation. It's a big time of transition for them as a people. Times of transition in our life are not easy. Times of big change in our life are not easy times. And so often when discouragement is coupled with those times, it makes us especially vulnerable to a loss of perspective, causes us to see our problems, our situation, our transition, the relationships that are leaving our lives and the relationships that are coming into our lives as bigger than they sometimes are and sometimes bigger than our God. We know in our minds that they are not, but sometimes they would compete on that kind of a level. That's just the place the children of Israel find themselves in. Miriam has died, the great prophetess of Israel. Aaron, the great high priest, has now died, and his son has entered into that particular position as the high priest. This man that has been with them, the nation of Israel, for all of these decades, now gone, and now a new person in this position. And Moses has failed, striking the rock twice instead of speaking to the rock. And just when they needed a little help from their friends, a little help from family, a little help from the relatives, a little help from the descendants of Esau, the Edomites, there was no help forthcoming. Instead, opposition. And instead of being able to cut through the king's highway, which was a highway from the south to the north, on the east side of the Jordan, they said, we wouldn't bother anything. We won't touch anything that's yours. Just let us walk on that highway. Just let us take the shortcut through here. The Edomites said, no, you're not going to do it. And they sent an army forth to make sure that the children of Israel didn't cut through their land. So now they've got to walk all the way out around into the desert, all the way around to where they wanted to go. And it's very discouraging. And as if that isn't hard enough, it's at times like that that the enemy then attacks us. And that's exactly what happens to the children of Israel here. When the king of Arad, the Canaanite, an enemy of the children of Israel, who dwelt in the south, heard that Israel was coming on the road to this place, then he fought against Israel and took some of them prisoners. And so the enemy attacks at a time like this, just adding greater discouragement to the entire situation, to the point you just think, this is it. This is it. This is the end. And so Israel made a vow to the Lord. Times like that do have a tendency to drive us to the Lord, don't they? And said, if you will indeed deliver this people into my hand, then I will utterly destroy their cities. Now, their motivation here is not vengeance. Their motivation is not a bloodthirstiness on their part. Their motivation is a desire to protect themselves and to protect their children, to protect their families. They just wanted some peace, but they're being attacked. And the Lord listened to the voice of Israel and delivered up the Canaanites, and they utterly destroyed them and their cities. And so the name of that place was called Hormah, which means destruction. So if you find yourself in that place of great discouragement tonight, know that you just must keep putting one foot in front of the other until you see the victory of the Lord. How else will we learn faith? How else will character be developed in my life? And I wish there was a correspondence course, the character building correspondence course. All it would be is just building up my brain in what character looks like in everybody else. But real character in my life, real faith in my life, comes by being put in situations continually that are beyond my resources and beyond me. And God is faithful to do that, because he has a plan for my life. And the plan for my life is bigger than my life. He has big plans, big desires. There's a big picture that he sees as it relates to this day, this generation, this hour, but also the history of man. Never see your life any smaller than that. Never see it smaller than that. By the grace of God, by his power, by his calling, by his sovereignty. But never limit him and never see it smaller than that. However big or largely it might be recognized by the rest of the people on planet Earth. And then they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom. And the soul of the people became very discouraged on the way. And the people spoke against God and against Moses. And they said, why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die? Did they have like a record or something? Was this like a big hit? I mean, every time things go bad, this is the first thing that comes out of their mouth. There's no food and there's no water. Ah, there was food and water. And our soul loathes this loathsome bread, this manna. Oh, there was food. We just didn't like the food. There was food. There just wasn't restaurants. Five-course meals. But there was provision for their needs. And this is a passage where we can look at the children of Israel and we can say, you know, I can understand their complaining, but I have to understand and recognize what part of me understands their complaining, and the part of me that understands it is my flesh. And God isn't pleased with it. Though we understand it, he's not pleased with it. The complaining against him, because it's a reflection upon him. The complaining of God's people against God is continually a reflection on him, not a true reflection. But the ungodly don't know that. And so the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people. Now, in my mind, there can only be one thing worse than a regular serpent, loose. That's a fiery serpent. I don't know what a fiery serpent looks like. Glows in the dark, breathes fire, you know, at night. Anything like a serpent loose in my house. In the dark. There'll be no rest in our home until this is taken care of. And as if it couldn't get worse, they then bit the people. Now, the only thing worse than a regular bite of a serpent would be the bite of a fiery serpent, I suppose. Never been bitten by a snake. And many of the people of Israel died. Therefore the people came to Moses and said, we have sinned, for we have spoken against the Lord and against you. Pray to the Lord that he would take away, that he take away the serpents from us. And so Moses prayed for the people. And then the Lord said to Moses, make a fiery serpent, make it out of bronze, and set it on a pole. And it shall be everyone who is bitten, when he looks at that fiery bronze serpent, looks in faith, shall live. And so Moses made a bronze serpent and put it on a pole, and so it was. If the serpent had bitten anyone, when he looked at the bronze serpent, he was saved, or he lived. Jesus takes this particular passage out of the entirety of the Old Testament as an example to describe salvation by faith and what happens when an individual looks to the work of Jesus Christ on the cross, what happens in their life spiritually. We have all of us been bitten by the serpent. We have all of us been bitten by sin, introduced by the serpent, the devil, in the Garden of Eden. We are all of us dying. It's a living death that we live, but we're all dying. To be born into this world is to be born to die. That's all there is to it. And the reason that we die is because of sin. And so here we are, Jesus saying that we have been bitten by that serpent, we have been bitten by that sin, and the wages of that sin is death. And Jesus said, whoever will look to the work of Jesus on the cross, believing, will be saved. So a person is separated from the Lord, has no relationship with Him. And they come and they say, Father, I believe, God, I believe that Your Son, Jesus Christ, died on the cross for my sins, and that His death upon the cross is the full and satisfying payment for my sin. And I look to Him and His work upon the cross for my salvation. I put my faith for my salvation in what He has done, not in what I have done, can do, or will ever do, but in what He has done upon the cross, and I believe that He was buried and rose again. And in that moment, when someone looks to the work of Jesus on the cross, in that moment, life comes into them. When they look by faith, say, I believe that, and I give You my life. In that moment, they move from death unto life. They go from being spiritually dead to being spiritually alive. Now, it's interesting that in this situation, God takes and He has the object that the people are to look at. He makes it out of bronze, which is the metal of judgment in the Old Testament, and He makes it out of the very thing that was plaguing the people. It's interesting that we're told in the second epistle to the Corinthians, chapter 5, verse 21, that He who knew no sin, Jesus, became sin in order that we might become the righteousness of God in Him. And so Jesus, again, this is a beautiful type and picture of Jesus. He bore our sin upon the cross. He became what we are. He did not become sinful because He never sinned, but He bore our sins. He became that which was afflicting us, the bearing of our sins, even as Moses is instructed to take that serpent, make it out of bronze, and place it upon a pole. Now, the way of salvation for the children of Israel here in this particular journey as it related to the fiery serpents was very simple. God comes to them and says very simply, here's what I want you to do. In order for you to be saved as it relates to being bit by these serpents, I want you to do 1,000 push-ups, I want you to score 2,000 on your SAT, if there is such a number. I want you to do this, this, and this, and then you'll overcome the being bit by the serpent. Now, if God came to us like that and says, listen, you can save yourself and here's how you do it, man, we'd get into that. How far do I have to crawl on my hands and knees through broken glass to get... I mean, people love that kind of stuff. They love it. Because there's somehow in our minds an idea that we must suffer in a relationship with God or we're not doing it right. And so we have that idea as it relates to salvation. And so what do I got to do? How much penance? How much do I need to whip myself? What do I need to do in order to earn and this kind of thing? And God comes along and says, no, it's not based upon that at all. It's based upon looking and living. A look of faith. And in order to look at that serpent on that pole would be an expression of their faith. God said, look and you'll live. So I'm not going to look. I don't believe it. Don't believe it. I don't believe that. I don't know. I don't see how in the world that could have anything to do with the fact that I've got a fiery serpent attached to my calf right now and that can do anything for me. I want nothing to do with it. God says, listen, if you will just look as an expression of your faith, your obedience is an expression of your faith in the salvation that I have provided, you'll find it to be sufficient for your need. And that's the big thing that people really grapple with as it relates to the salvation that's found in Jesus Christ. It has to do with the gospel and Christianity. They come in and listen. These are very real things that people deal with. We've all dealt with them. Jesus died on the cross for my sins. Now, some of us, I mean, we heard that. And we said, great, He'll take us. Where do I sign? so thrilled that he would want to be identified with us. Others struggle with these kinds of things. And they look and they think to themselves, you know, I just don't understand. I don't understand how that works. I don't understand why that would work. I don't understand how that can impact my situation at all. My dying, my death spiritually, my separation from I don't understand how looking to Jesus as the full payment for my sins upon the cross, putting my trust in Him and in His work, I don't see how that is related to my sinfulness and my need. It is related for this reason. It's related because that is God's provision. That's all there needs to be. That's the entire issue. If He had done it 1,000 different ways, and He couldn't have, but if He had, all that matters is that's the way that He has chosen to do it. And since reconciliation has to occur between man and God, all that matters is that whatever the means of salvation is, be satisfying to God. And that is satisfying to God. And that is the only salvation that's satisfying to Him. It's the only one that meets the need. Meets the need in the way that He knows that it needs to be met. And so often a person says, I don't understand. You will never understand it this side of glory. And you may not understand it the other side of glory. It may remove worship from our hearts to understand it fully. I don't know. All we need to know is that this is the salvation God has provided. It perfectly matches our need. And when I look to Jesus' work upon the cross in faith, believing, trusting in His work for my life, then it undoes the bite of the serpent. It undoes the bite of the enemy and sin, the consequences of sin in my life. So that's the key issue, most important issue. People are driven crazy over the fact that God has made salvation so easy. If He'd have made it hard, Swinley English Channel, there would be lines tonight at the English Channel. No, He's made it a free gift, but it requires looking by faith, believing, and then you live. And then, having believed and having looked, He gives you plenty of evidence. The evidence of the indwelling of God's Holy Spirit. We become what we know we could never have become in and of ourselves. Now the children of Israel, verse 10, moved on and camped in Oboth. And they journeyed from Oboth and camped at this place in the wilderness which is east of Moab toward the sunrise. Now there they moved and camped in the valley of Zered. And from there they moved and camped on the other side of Arnon, which is in the wilderness that extends from the border of the Amorites, for the Arnon is the border of Moab between Moab and the Amorites. Therefore, it is said in the book of the wars of the Lord, this is a book that is non-existent in the sense that it's been lost and we have known nothing about it, Wahab in Sufa, the brooks of the Arnon and the slope of the brooks that reaches to the dwelling of Ar and lies on the border of Moab. So a description of this river and a description of this border between Moab and the Amorites. And from there they went to Beer, which is well, means well, which is the well where the Lord said to Moses, gather the people together and I will give them water. And then Israel sang this song. So a song written to celebrate God's blessing and provision of water for them in a time of need. Spring up, O well. All of you sing to it. The well the leaders sank, dug by the nation's nobles, by the lawgiver with their staves. And from the wilderness they went to this place, and from there to there, and from there to here, and from here to there in the valley, that is in the valley of Moab, on the top of Pisgah, which looks down on the wasteland. And then Israel sent messengers to Sihon, the king of the Amorites. They just want to pass through this area again. Let me pass through your land, and we will not turn aside into the fields or vineyards. We will not drink water from wells, but we will go by the king's highway until we've passed through your territory. But Sihon would not allow Israel to pass through his territory. So Sihon gathered all his people together, went out against Israel in the wilderness, and he came to Jahaz and fought against Israel. And so Moses comes to him and says, listen, let's just cut through your land. It's not going to cost you anything. And they come out and they attack God's people. They attack the children of Israel. And then Israel defeated him with the edge of the sword and took possession of his land from the Arnon to the Jabbok as far as the people of Ammon, for the border of the people of Ammon was fortified. And so Israel took all these cities, and Israel dwelt in all of the cities of the Amorites in Heshbon and in its villages. For Heshbon was the city of Sihon, the king of the Amorites, who had fought against the former king of Moab and had taken all his land from his hand as far as Arnon. So here we have the Amorites. They are dwelling in a section of land that actually belongs to the Moabites, but they're occupying that land because they've defeated the Moabites. And now they have a little song that they sang in these villages of the Amorites here, as it relates to Sihon's conquest of Moab. Therefore, those who speak in Proverbs say, come to Heshbon, let it be built, let the city of Sihon be repaired. For the fire went out from Heshbon, a flame from the city of Sihon. It consumed Ar of Moab, the lords of the heights of Arnon. Woe to you, Moab! You have perished, O people of Chemosh, which was the principal Moabite god. He has given his sons as fugitives and his daughters into captivity to Sihon, king of the Amorites. But we have shot at them. Heshbon has perished as far as Dibon. And then he laid waste as far as Naphtah, which reaches to Medeba. And thus Israel dwelt in the land of the Amorites. And then Moses sent to spy out Jazer, and they took its villages and drove out the Amorites who were there. Now the Amorites were some pretty tough people. They come out to attack them, and then the children of Israel defeat them. It's a pretty big thing. But it's not over with yet. And they turned and went up by the way to Bashan. And so Og, king of Bashan, went out against them, he and all his people, to battle at this place. And then the Lord said to Moses, do not fear him, for I have delivered him into your hand with all his people and his land. You shall do to him as you did to Sihon, king of the Amorites, who dwelt in Heshbon. And so, with that promise of the Lord and the Lord with him, so they defeated him, his sons, and all his people until there was no survivor left him, and they took possession of his plain. Now, the Canaanites were defeated, then the Amorites were defeated, and then Og is defeated before the nation of Israel. The timing of it and the recording of this is very, very interesting, because the children of Israel are getting closer and closer to the land of promise. Very soon they're going to enter into the promised land where they had been 38 years earlier and because of unbelief had failed to go in. And the closer and closer they get to this life of victory, this life within the promised land, the greater the opposition by the enemies of God's people. And so it happens. And so they begin to attack. One of the things that's interesting about walking as a Christian is the realization that spiritual warfare is kind of a thing that, you know, you're not going to go through for, you know, go through the 6-week course on that and then done with that. Whew, man, I got to be out of that through. I have to take that again. Wow. Man, let's get out of that prosperity thing quick. And so, but it doesn't operate that way. Every time as we move into these lands of promise and we move out on God's promises, we can expect an attack. Now, I am very, very thankful for the respites and the breaks that God gives us in the course of the warfare that we're involved in. But sometimes I get a little shaky when it goes too long. You just kind of get used to the ongoing resistance. And it's not always a bad sign, as we'll see in just a moment. Why does God allow these enemies to attack his people at all anyway? Number one, he's developing faith in them. Remember, the older generation has died away now. They were prepared through the works of God, the miracles of God coming out of Egypt, and then in the time of going from Egypt to Kadesh Barnea. He was developing a relationship with them and demonstrating his great power to them, that they had nothing to fear as it related to their enemies because their God was with them. And so now this new generation, he's just developing faith with in their lives. And so they go from one piece of warfare to the next piece of warfare to the next piece of warfare, and God is faithful in all of it, and their faith is developed as a result of it. They know that, hey, God is working here. God is able to wipe out even the strongest of these attacks that come against me, because they're going to go into the promised land, and the promised land is a land flowing with milk and honey, but it was also a land of great warfare, great, great resistance. So God's developing faith within his people. He's preparing them for what's going to come into their life tomorrow. Now, sometimes when you're in spiritual warfare and God is preparing you for what he knows is coming into your life tomorrow, you can wonder, by virtue of the spiritual warfare, my goodness, what's coming into my life tomorrow? It's fruitfulness, just greater fruitfulness. And so here is what he's doing. He's always got his eye on tomorrow. He's always got his eye on the next thing. He's always got his eye on the multitude. Sometimes we just would like to say, well, you know, I read through the New Testament one time, and I've memorized, you know, Romans Road and that kind of thing. I'd like to just get a stack of books and find a nice lazy boy chair and just sit and just relax until the trump, until, you know, we go to be with the Lord. Just like to be in that place. But that's not the way that the Lord operates, because there's a lot of people who are yet to come into contact with him, and he has chosen to use us as it relates to that entire work. So here is the children of Israel. They've gathered now in the plains of Moab, and they're waiting now for word from God to move in and take the promised land. And then the children of Israel moved and camped in the plains of Moab on the side of Jordan across from Jericho. So strategically right in place, right where God's going to cross them in. Now Balak, the son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. And Moab was exceedingly afraid of the people because they were many. And Moab was sick with dread because of the children of Israel. Please understand that. When you and I think that, you know, Satan is really giving us a bad time, and boy, we're really going through it, and this is really hard, you know, the resistance that we're getting, understand that the work of God in your life is driving the enemies of God quite crazy. And it has them sick with dread. Here is Balak, who is over this particular group of Moabites. He has seen the Canaanites defeated. He's seen the Amorites defeated. He's seen Og defeated. And not only has he seen the Amorites defeated, but his nation, the Moabites, were defeated by the Ammonites. So here a greater army, a greater people militarily, has been defeated by the children of Israel. And now the children of Israel have decided to camp right next to Balak, the son of Zippor, right next to the Moabites. And Balak, flash of genius goes on in his mind, and he realizes, wait a second, we are lunch for these people. We are the next meal in their journey. They're going to wipe us out next. And for us as God's children, as we walk in God's promises, as we near the promised land, which is walking in the promises of God revealed in his word, as we walk in that life of victory, and even as we approach that life of victory, it produces fear in the hearts of the enemies of God and God's people. They can look at a life wandering in the wilderness, doesn't bother them at all. That person calls themselves a Christian. They wander in the wilderness of complaining. They wander in the wilderness of unbelief. They're no threat at all. But when a Christian becomes serious about his inheritance in Jesus Christ and begins to possess the possession that's been given to him, then he causes all manner of fear in the hearts of these enemies. And so the result is going to be warfare. But warfare in those situations are a good sign. And so you will, in the course of your Christian walk, as we're serious in our walk with the Lord, we are going to gain the attention of our enemies, knowing that at the same time it's striking fear into their hearts. Not because of us, but because they recognize in looking at us. I mean, look at us. Look at the body of Christ. Is there anything more spastic in all of the world? Is there really anything more ridiculous in all of the world than 80% of Christian television? Seriously. I mean, you look at what the body of Christ does. And God, out of His grace, out of His great love, they continue to multiply, they continue to grow, they continue to move forward. And anyone can look at it and realize it's not them. Somebody's in them. Somebody's with them. So it produces a fear within their hearts. And so Moab said to the elders of Midian, "Now this company will lick up all that is around us as an ox licks up the grass of the field." Now, a piece of grass fares very poorly against an ox. They said, these people are going to come in and they're going to eat us like an ox eats grass. And Balak the son of Zippor was king of the Moabites at that time. And he sent messengers to Balaam the son of Beor of this place, which is near the river in the land of the sons of his people, to call him, saying, "Look, a people has come out from Egypt, and see, they cover the face of the earth, and they're settling next to me." And so here is Balaam, and he's over in the region of Mesopotamia, between the Tigris and the Euphrates River. And Balak knows that this guy is alive. Balaam is a funny guy in the Scriptures. You'll never figure him out. And if you figure him out, write a book and send me a copy. I'll write a foreword for you on it. He's a man who had great prophetic gifts. In fact, the prophecies of Balaam in the Old Testament are second to none in many respects. Concerning his prophecy, concerning Messiah, really second to none. And so here is this guy that was used by God, gifted by God. God was doing great things through his life. And yet he's a weird cookie, as we're going to see shortly. But they knew that this guy was associated with God, the true and the living God. They knew he was a prophet. They knew where to find him. And so they send, "Go to this guy, tell him that I'm in a pinch here, and ask him to come over," verse 6, "at once, and curse this people for me, for they're too mighty for me. Perhaps I shall be able to defeat them and drive them out of the land, for I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed." And so he looks at this great army of the children of Israel and he says, "We cannot defeat them outwardly. We cannot fight them person to person in battle and win. We must somehow win this thing in the spiritual realm." And so he now turns to subtlety in order to defeat the children of Israel, calls for this prophet. And so the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with the diviner's fee, the standard honorarium for a prophet in that day, whatever that might be. And they came to Balaam and they spoke to him the words of Balak. And Balaam said to them, "Lodge here tonight and I will bring back word to you as the Lord speaks to me." And so the princes of Moab stayed with Balaam. And then God came to Balaam and said to him, "Who are these men with you? What kind of company are you keeping? Who you got at your house? What are you doing talking to these guys? What are you doing talking to that kind of a person? What are you doing listening to them. Who are these men who are with you? We ask ourselves tonight. Could the Lord say that to us and the Balaam within us? Who are these people you're with? Who are you listening to? Who are you hanging out with? Wrong associations plays a very big part in Balaam's fall. It's not the big reason he falls. It's not the big reason he fails. But it has a place in it. We must be careful of our associations. And Balaam said to God, Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab, has sent to me saying, look, a people has come out of Egypt and they cover the face of the earth. Come now, curse them for me. Perhaps I shall be able to overpower them and drive them out. And God said to Balaam, you shall not go with them. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed. That's nice. That's nice. God said, listen, don't go with them. Can't curse them. They're blessed. It's interesting that that is God's assessment of his people, the children of Israel. They are blessed. And what's funny to me, and it's a great exhortation to my heart, is that God knew that they were blessed, but they were so busy complaining that they never realized how blessed they were. You ever notice that about complaining? I mean, you can have everything in the world. You can have a nice, bright, sunny day. You can have all kinds of different things, and complaining robs me of knowing how blessed I am. So he says, these guys are blessed. Don't mess with them. You can't. Don't go with them. Don't even try and curse them. It'd be fruitless. So Balaam rose in the morning and said to the princes of Balak, go back to your land, for the Lord has refused to give me permission to go with you. Very bad. And this is the verse that is the key to the fall of Balaam. Verse 13. Go back to your land, and then he says, for the Lord has refused to give me permission to go with you. He reveals that his heart is not in line with what he's saying. And his heart is not in line with what God has told him to do. And he's communicating, I would go with you, but I can't go with you because God said I can't. There's a big difference between when temptation comes my way, some payment of the enemy to get me to join in his devices. There's a big difference between when that temptation comes to me and I look at that temptation and I say, should such a man as I involve myself in this? Get out of my house. I won't have anything to do with it. God says I'm not to have anything to do with it, and I'm with God 100% in this. And there you reveal to the enemy, to the tempter, that my heart is in complete alignment with God and His will. It's another thing to come as it relates to temptation and say, listen, the Lord won't let me go. Big difference. And the enemy recognizes it. Because what it's communicating is, God won't let me go, but I desperately want the money that you're offering. And it communicates, negotiations are still open. And all that it does is it creates enormous trial for me. Because when a Balak, or when a worse than Balak, Satan, knows that I'm open for negotiation and I don't close doors and I don't burn bridges, then he has enormous resources. He will simply up the ante and he will be back. And oftentimes a person will say, well, I just don't know why I'm constantly, you know, hounded in this thing and hounded in that thing. Over and over and over again, the door's not slammed. There's that recognition of, listen, God won't let me do it. And there's a world of difference between the Christian walk where a person is walking with the Lord and God says, no, don't do that. And you say, boy, the wisdom of the Lord is perfect. Every command of His is based upon perfect love for me. He knows what He's talking about. And when He says no, that means no. I don't want anything to do with it. I don't want anything to do with that. So no. And I say no out of the recognition of how great is God's love towards me, and out of relationship with Him. Far different from the person who is walking with the Lord and they are walking against their will. Oh, I've got to say no to that. No. The Lord tells me to say no to that. No. The Lord tells me to say no to that. No. How long do you last? Yeah, about 15 minutes. About three times, about what our strength is, unless He unleashes all of His fury in terms of offering in the first offer. It's a big difference. That's why God spoke to Solomon and He warned Solomon. Solomon fell because of a divided heart. His heart was stolen away by his many wives. The issue is to guard our hearts. Guard our hearts. And our hearts must be in line with what we're saying. Jesus, in the temptation of Satan against Him that we looked at this morning, when Jesus said, "It is written," and I didn't have time to get into it this morning because I went long enough. But Jesus, when He said, "It is written," He wasn't just spouting off some verse. It was a verse He believed. It was a verse that was a part of His life. It was a verse His life was under. It wasn't something that He was fighting against. And so the importance, when the enemy attacks me, that I close the door, that I don't in any way communicate, the negotiations are still open. He reads that. And Balak is going to read it. And he's going to be back. Many ways we can create our own trials, and there are enough trials without creating our own. And the princes of Moab rose and went to Balak. And Balak said, "Balaam refuses to come with us." And then Balak again. Now, temptation very rarely ends with just a single saying of no. Balak again sent princes, more numerous, more honorable than the prior ones. Sorry, guys. And they came to Balaam and said to him, "Thus says Balak the son of Zippor, please let nothing hinder you from coming to me, for I will certainly honor you greatly, and I will do whatever you say to me. Therefore, please come, curse this people for me." And now here is Balak coming to Balaam, and he in essence says, "Name your price. Name your price. What do you want? You don't want a diviner's fee. What do you want? Do you want power? Do you want money? Do you want position? What do you want? Whatever you want, I'll offer it to you." The enemy does the same thing in our lives. And it's so important that we not be men and women with a price. Balaam is a man with a price. You can encapsulate his life that way. Man with a price. Walked with God until his price was off. Now, we're not to be men and women with a price because the Bible teaches that we are no longer our own when we came to know the Lord. Our lives are God's. They're not ours to take back and sell for anything. I will not offer my life for that price or for any price. My life is no longer mine to negotiate with. It belongs to another person. Very important that I see my life that way. And so here is Balak. Very much a picture of Satan, very much a picture of spiritual warfare here. And he comes and he says, "Name your price." And I'm absolutely convinced that if we have a price, Satan will come up with it. I mean, he'll get into his penny collection and he'll get it all out of there, and then he'll sell his stamp collection and whatever it might be, you know, whatever that thing might be that might be the price. I mean, ultimately he'll offer. He'll come forward and walk. He'll at least pretend that he's got it. I'm just going to show you 10% of it right now. I've got the full payment if you'll just do this. And he works that way. I think in a very real sense, as it relates to the gifts that God has given us in terms of ministry and our place in the body of Christ, there's a point where God develops a faith within our life in Him concerning those gifts. There's a fruit associated with those callings and with those gifts. And there's a point where God says to us, "Listen, you know what I've given to you. You know what I've called you to. And you have a free will as it relates to this gift and to this calling. And you're going to be offered prices for that gift and for that calling the rest of your life. And understand that. And make sure that you don't have a price. Because the Satan will come up with it. Balak comes up with it. Says, whatever, give it to you. So they send. Always greater people, more significant people bringing these things. And Balaam says, now therefore, verse 19, please. No, Balaam answered verse 18. And said to the servants of Balak, though Balak were to give his house full of silver and gold, I could not go beyond the word of my Lord to do more, less, or more. Now that would have been a good sentence to send them away on, but his heart's divided. And then he says, now therefore, please, you also stay here tonight that I may know more. Know what more the Lord will say to me. Well, what more does the Lord need to say? What is it about no that you don't understand, son? And the great people get in enormous trouble trying to see what more. I know God told me no. I know He told me no. I know what I'm supposed to do there. I know that He's told me no as it relates to that. But I'm just going to keep, you know, hammering away at Him, you know, to see what more that He might say there. It's not a wise thing to do. So He operates as if the issue is still open because He still wants the reward. He's desirous of the money. He's desirous of the reward. And Balaam is a man with a secret sin in his heart. There really is no secret sin before God, and there's no secret sin before men ultimately. It always surfaces given enough time. And his sin is covetousness. Now, whether you or I have problems with covetousness, only the Lord knows and we know. But we all have temptation as it relates to some particular area. And so covetousness was the thing that was a real hard thing for Balaam here. And God came to Balaam at night and said to him, if the men come to call you, rise and go with them. But only the word which I speak to you, that you shall do. And so Balaam rose in the morning, saddled his donkey, and went with the princes of Moab. I think he was probably saddled up about 3 in the morning, ready to go, pretty eager. And then God's anger was aroused when he went. And the angel of the Lord took his stand in the way as an adversary against him. And he was riding on his donkey. And you can almost picture him on this. Maybe he's just going on that little donkey. And his 2 servants were with him. You know, you need help carrying all that kind of loot. And the donkey saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand, and the donkey turned aside out of the way and went into the field. Whoop, just went right out in the field, right off of the path. Balaam, absolutely angry, he struck the donkey to turn her back onto the road. Isn't it interesting how angry we can get related to circumstances that God has sent to save us from our own destruction? Things that get in our way when we're driving and riding very swiftly towards greed and covetousness and riches. Oh, you get angry fast, don't you? Don't get in my way on this road, dumb donkey. And there just beats that donkey back onto the road. Then the angel of the Lord stood on a narrow path between the vineyards, with a wall on this side and a wall on that side. So you see the donkey coming right through with Balaam on the back of it, a stone wall on either side. And when the donkey saw the angel of the Lord standing there in the way, she can't go to the left, she can't go to the right, so she pushes herself against the wall and she crushes Balaam's foot against the wall. And so he struck her again. Then the angel of the Lord went further and stood in a narrow place where there was no way to turn either to the right hand or to the left, no wall to jam into. And when the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, she lay down under Balaam. That can really make you mad. Your transportation goes out on you like that. You're headed for the biggest payday of your life. Your dreams come true. All the big bucks are waiting. And your transportation goes out on you. Stupid donkey.
He takes and he struck the donkey with his staff. Now he's beat this donkey 3 times, and he doesn't understand that the donkey's more sensitive to what's going on in the spiritual realm at this moment than he is. Which isn't unusual. And then the Lord opened the mouth of the donkey, and she said to Balaam, "What have I done to you that you've struck me these 3 times? Wilbur?" There's nothing new under the sun, I'm telling you. It's all right here in this book. And so here is this donkey, and this donkey isn't just talking, you know, just reciting the ABCs. This donkey's making sense. "What have I done to you that you've struck me these 3 times? And Balaam is so mad that he doesn't even flip out over the fact that a donkey's talking to him, doesn't even notice it. He begins to answer back to the donkey, "Because you abused me, and I wish there were a sword in my hand, for now I would kill you." So the donkey said to Balaam, "Am I not your donkey, on which you've ridden ever since I became yours to this day? Didn't you buy me new? Was I ever disposed to do this to you?" Balaam said, "No. There's only one thing worse than talking to a donkey, and that's losing an argument to a donkey." And that's what's happening here with him. He's checkmated. So blinded by greed, so blinded by his area, his secret sin of his heart. Gotta get there. You apply it to your area. And then the Lord opened Balaam's eyes, and he saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way. And I believe this is nothing other than a theophany, a Christophany, a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ with his drawn sword in his hand. And he bowed his head and he fell flat on his face before the Lord. The angel of the Lord said to him, "Why have you struck your donkey these 3 times? The donkey had a good point, Balaam. It's a good question. What's going on in your heart? What are you in such a hurry to get to? To speak for me? Sure. To declare my truth? Sure you are. What's going on in there, Balaam? What's going on inside of there? Where's all this anger coming from? Where's all the wrath coming from? Behold, I have come to stand against you because your way is perverse." The word perverse means to hurl headlong towards destruction. You are headed for destruction, Balaam, before me. The donkey saw me and turned aside from me these 3 times, and if she had not turned aside from me, surely I would have also killed you by now and let her live. She saved your life, or I would have had your head by now, buddy. And Balaam said to the angel, "I've sinned, for I did not know that you stood in the way against me. Now, therefore, if it displeases you, I will turn back." And then the angel of the Lord said to Balaam, "Go with the men, but only the word that I speak to you, that you shall speak." And so Balaam went with the princes of Balak. I don't know if it's been your experience, but it's been my experience that every time I've been on the wrong road in my Christian walk, headed towards something in some place that I am not supposed to be on or headed towards, the Lord has always been faithful to warn me. Always been faithful to. Always been faithful. Some means. Usually a still small voice, usually the work of His Spirit, just bringing conviction in my heart, sometimes through another person, sometimes through the Word, but always faithful to warn me. He is faithful to warn us. He's faithful to warn Balaam here, but Balaam is not going to listen to him. Now when Balak heard that Balaam was coming, he went out to meet him at the city of Moab, which is on the border of the Arnon, the boundary of the territory. And then Balak said to Balaam, "Did I not earnestly send to you, coming for you? Why did you not come to me? Am I not able to honor you?" Balaam said to Balak, he's a little upset right now, look, I've come to you. Now, have I any power to say at all to say anything? The word that God puts in my mouth, that I shall speak. And so Balaam went with Balak, and they came to Kirjath-Herzoth. And then Balak offered oxen and sheep, and he sent some to Balaam and to the princes who were with him. And we'll stop there and we'll pick it up in verse 41, or really chapter 23, next week as we continue this whole account of Balaam and Balak and moving beyond. The continuation, and I almost hate to stop in the middle of this. I'm not remotely tempted to go further to rest your, set your heart at ease. But it's a fascinating account, and it's in its entirety. And so what happens beyond here is really every bit as amazing and filled with instruction as what we've looked at tonight.